This is the podcast Bilder Denken. I am here with Asem Hendawi. Here is a bit difficult to say because I'm in Berlin and Asem is in Cairo. And we will be talking about his film Simia, Stratagems for Undestining, which is part of the Forum Expanded 2023 in the film program. Hi, Asem.
Hi, Wally. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. And thank you that you are willing and ready to talk with me about your film.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Okay, so we just start with a basic question, like what does the title of your film mean? Simia, Stratagems for Undestining. I think there is a lot of to unpack here.
Yes. I think we can start with Simia, which is like an abbreviated word. It comes from the Arabic. It comes from a word called Simia in Arabic. And Simia can translate to many things. In the most basic sense, it's alchemy, it's magic, but also like within Islamic Sufism and occultist practices, it's a way of knowing. Obviously, it could translate to the epistemology of wisdom. The thing about it that it's like when I say magic, I'm doing a lot of reduction to the word itself, because it's this kind of practice was usually like a systematic, almost algorithmic process of rearranging words that are considered holy, and they are containers of divine power. So by rearranging the words and by kind of creating a magical formula out of them, you are able to manipulate divine agency. Simia also share a root with the word Simia'iyya, which is semiotics in Arabic. So yeah, I think that's what the word means. But and I find it interesting because I think semantically and metaphorically it relates to this curious phase we're in with artificial intelligence as an infant technology, and because it has so many potentials around it, but also has so many wishes around it, and also had a lot of like alienation in the sense that it's alien to us as we go. So I found the word compelling in that it can capture all that in a way.
Yeah, I mean, when I read it or saw it the first time, I also had this association with similar, like stuff being similar, and with AI, obviously, what we try to do is to make it similar to us humans. But what we notice is that it's alien, similar and alien, which has this kind of uncanny valley thing. Yeah, the stuff that is most similar that is also very uncanny and strange and weird, and we're afraid of it.
Like, I think there is a lot of ways. I'm trying to think about artificial intelligence in the film. Maybe as the conversation goes, we go into more. But for starters, yeah, when it comes to the name, it was about this, trying to capture this moment, because at the end of the day, at one particular historical moment, these occultish practices that are now frowned upon are considered modes of knowing, you know, and of knowledge production in a way. And I'm not saying that they still are. I'm just saying that you are in this particular moment where you can make these even metaphorical relations between like any alien technology that is still in the making, and it's like its promises are still yet to be seen, and also was occultist practice, I guess. Yeah.
So what was your interest like to use these reference to occultist practices in with like technology? Because I mean, what was your interest? But I noticed also that a lot of people who work about digital and the technical refer back to this kind of whole magic stuff. I don't know, there is this interest in tarot and technology and all kinds of like, you know, magical spiritual stuff, which is surprising in a way, because one would think that AI and technology is very removed from that and very, I don't know, clean, and magic and stuff is kind of considered, you know, this dark things that's happening underground.
Yeah, I think when it comes to magic and its relation to technology, like there is this quote by Arthur C. Clarke that is any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I am not interested, to be honest, in reviving any magical practices or actually suggesting that magic is an alternative or sufficient mode of production on its own. But I'm just interested in making these comparison in terms of the social cultural way we actually position ourselves in relation to technology, especially technologies that are still advancing, that are still getting, like artificial intelligence in all its forms, it's very new, it's a very infant, it's going to change, it's going to have a thousand faces. So in a way, it's all this distancing that we have from what it could be that makes this comparison appealing to me. There is also a particular kind of occultist practices that comes from that I described, that comes from the word semia, that you could have seen them as technologies of their time. Technologies that they didn't work because they were not real, but they are perceived as such. Like the for example, the Islamic talisman is the talisman that is constructed by taking the words or the names of God and like cutting it in different ways and rearranging them according to the rules of astrology and how the movement of planets work in order, for example, to affect a change in the world, you know, like making someone who is sick feel better, making someone fall in love with you, you know. So in a way, they were considered technologies. They did not work, because they were not real. And I think the comparison in that sense is what I'm trying to do, because you have all these questions and potentialities around artificial intelligence, you know, like it's going to be God at some point. You have all this talk about singularity, which is, I think it's a little bit out there. It's never going to happen in that way. So this is the kind of very, for me, compelling way. So I know that I might be taking a risk by making the comparison, but at the same time, I cannot just ignore it, because all of the complex and conflicted things that are being said and thought about technology like artificial intelligence have these also magical elements about them in a way.
What I said before, you are not the only one who's interested in these kind of comparisons. And also when you, I don't know, look at this broader society, I noticed that, for example, people are getting back into astrology. So how does this renewed interest in magic, where does it come from? In a broader kind of social or artistic?
Like, I'm just trying to, like, honestly distance myself from a particular kind of relation with magic, because I'm always interested in magic in a naturalist sense, like in an anthropological or epistemological sense, like how these modes of knowing or the modes that pretend to be modes of knowing, like how they function, where their culture came from. And these are the kind of comparisons I'm making. But I think some other like culture practitioners in the most general sense, like actually go back to them believing that they are valid modes of knowledge, of knowing and knowledge production. I mean, I think there is a particular historical moment where you have a lot of the core, you are in a post-truth moment historically, like it's very hard to know what's true from false. You have a lot of effects of the social media and the entanglement of these very different worlds are hitting together. Like national identities are at risk, personal identities, the way we used to know ourselves, are at risk, and there is a big unknown, especially how technology is progressing and making everything like shift very, you know, like fastly. So I think there is a culture reaction. For me, it's a reactionary movement in the negative sense of the word. Like they are trying to go back to something to give them more safety in face of this whole new technological, social, political, epistemological challenges.
Yeah.
That are born within this historical moment because of technology, but also because of all the political complication of the world we live in right now.
I just found it interesting how like you said, this at historical moment with technology, this is getting back. And I liked your Arthur C. Clarke, each technology that's advanced enough looks like magic. Because, I mean, I guess if you talk with ChatGPT, with this OpenAI chat that everybody's talking about now, it has something like talking with a genie in a bottle or something, you know?
Yeah, that's precisely that.
It is in a bottle because we don't know the algorithms behind them, because I guess Microsoft is not, a lot of stuff is not public, definitely. So, but corporate knowledge.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, but also just a point, I think historically magic was always connected technology, at any given period. You know, think of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and electricity. You know, electricity was a form of magic back then, when it started to appear to people, and the way the shock of the new was happening, it was always on this cognitive threshold, this is unreal because we were never used to it. So that's always there. And of course, with ChatGPT and all the different kind of programs that you will be seeing now and you'll be seeing in the future, I think it's always going to be there. And they're going to get more uncannier and more complicated as we go, actually. Yani, ChatGPT is just something that is very started. I don't know, how this model will evolve in 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now. You can even think it's going to be scary how good it will get.
When I talked, I mean, I did obviously also talk to ChatGPT, and it's kind of really interesting how I noticed myself talking to it and asking it, him, whatever, her questions, questions about stuff that I don't know about, really personal stuff, or can you give me advice how to do things better, that I found really kind of also weird in my approach, how I deal with it, as if it's, I don't know, an oracle and can give me, it is in a way an oracle in that way that is connecting or the collected knowledge of the world at a certain point, at a certain knowledge, obviously. So
definitely. I think so too. It's kind of an oracle, and I hope it stops there. It doesn't get to be a god at some point.
That's true, yeah.
An oracle, just fine. But, you know, you also had the same reaction to Google when it first started, for example, as this huge, massive search engine. And, you know, you can ask it anything and it will give you 1,000 answers. But this is just a different way of doing it, and it's much better. But it's funny how these things also work. I've read a study about how actually our memory works differently now because we have search engine, because we can outsource some of the memorizing labor we need to withhold information. We don't actually withhold information as much as we used to before, because you always have this prosthetic brain,
definitely.
Let's call it Google, who you can go to in a second to ask for answer. So it's super interesting with these technologies as they get more sophisticated. ChatGPT is one of them, is how they will influence us cognitively also, as well as politically and socially and every other aspect. I don't know if I'm giving a sufficient answer to that, but I did not spend a lot of time with ChatGPT because it recently just became open. And then usually when I have something like this starts to happen, for example, when Midjourney started, I was sitting there for 10 days a week, 24/7, just playing with it. So I know how much demanding this could get of me. So I'm just leaving it when I have a bit of time to be able to go all on it. But for now, the stuff I tried was super fascinating.
Yeah.
Problematic as well, but fascinating.
So you didn't, for the text, because I thought when I watched the film the first time that maybe you worked with, I don't know, automatic text production while with the voiceover of the text, because there is obviously not just a visual, but also a very textual level in the film.
No, it was the generation of the text itself and the content of the text was not by any aids of any artificial intelligence tools. The voices you hear that recorded voice is an AI software. Actually, they're not real people. But also the images that are used as textures in the world, where images were created by AI. Like, we used different prompts and fed it images on Midjourney. We had a lot of different images resulting from this process that we used in the creation of the word you see in the film, because it gave it the texture. It was all CGI, and the texture were made through AI images that actually, when we did it, it comes out as abstract, because also this was something new that we were trying. But we fed it actually a lot of historical images from the context of the Middle East. In the prompts, there was a lot of quotes by Franz Fanon and Karl Marx. They were the prompts that shaped the images. That gets obviously very distilled, because you don't see any of that. But Simia, like, the film itself is a project about one thing, and I'm working on a publication that will actually spread out the research process more. So all these things that were in the background gets foreground.
Yeah, maybe you can talk a bit about which were like the most important kind of prompts and images, what you are working on in the research.
When I started to work on this project, I wanted to create a certain kind of imaginary that was based in the Middle East and has some of these cultural forms that or histories that comes from the region to influence the outcome. But as I was working through the project, and as I was editing the text and thinking about the ideas I'm trying to work through, I felt that any particular local specificity, I wanted to be in the background, because this is a more like universal question, in the sense of like everybody's asking or thinking about these things. Of course, these things about it differently from their own context. But it was important for me at one point that this is abstract enough that they can still be relevant to you in a way. I'm not naive enough to say that universality works 100%, or at least how we understand the universal is something that needs a lot of unpacking. But for me, that I felt that there is something about the technology itself that is compelling to see it in this abstract eye. Maybe in the background work, there is a lot of things that comes from a particular context, but on the forefront, you can place it anywhere in that
sense.
But
maybe that would be interesting for our listeners and for me, obviously, because I don't know. I mean, I don't know where our listeners come from, but for the Western listeners, maybe to learn a bit more about this Middle Eastern context that you are talking about. And also what you talked about with the Simia Arabic word and the Islamic references, that maybe we wouldn't notice if we don't know about them.
Yeah, I mean, there is a section in the film where I speak about the Islamic occultists and like name them. They were scientists of the time, but they were also occultists at the same time, you know. I even had a pun, like made the AI try to pronounce the name Khwarizmi, which is, and it failed miserably. Khwarizmi is the name of the Arab scientist who created algebra, which is his name became algorithm, you know, Khwarizmi algorithm. One of the things that are super interesting to me is like when we look at this particular kind of history, we're talking about, I don't know, from 9th century to 13th century, all these sciences were developed in that period. You had a cutting edge understanding of technology of the times. There were a lot of sciences that are coming into being. One of them, for example, is algebra, which without it, there is no artificial intelligence, because there is no algorithms, you know. Obviously, things doesn't work like that. It's a continuity that we can reflect upon in retrospect. But I think I went back far. There was many moments that I could have chosen to like make the reference about the Middle Eastern Arab Islamic culture or whatever. But I chose this moment particularly because it's a moment that had all these conflicts together in them. For example, at that time, you know, Arabs and Muslims were the hegemons of the time. They were the powerful. They were the invaders. They were all these things, right? But they also were the ones who are developing the most cutting-edge technologies in the world. But also, they had the biggest... You had the biggest kind of resistances without this hegemony going on. So in that sense, it was a very interesting moment to go back to and reflect at the like at the creation of this kind of knowledge at this specific period in time. I don't know if this answers your questions, but I think it relates for me to, again, all the talk we talked about when it comes to, you know, occultism, magic, all that, because these were part-time scientists. They were polymaths who are part-time scientists, part-time alchemists, you know. There were no really distinction between both at the time. And then this is also tapped into, I jumped from that into the another found footage from Lord of the Rings and the Palantir technologies, which is, you know, the Palantir, the word Palantir, means the magic ball, the one in the film that you look into and see the future. The
crystal ball thing.
This is the crystal ball, exactly. That's its name, actually, in Lord of the Rings, the book, the story. It was called that. And this is actually where Palantir technologies...
What does Palantir technologies do?
Palantir technologies are one of the biggest big data mining companies, and they create different artificial intelligence-based softwares that aids in predictive policing, for example, aids in different future scenario planning on a mega scale levels, like they are subcontracted by the American Army. And their main thing, or at least one of their main things, is how you can mine as much data as possible and find as much tools to mine this data so you can actually tell the future in a way, right? This happens in forms of predictive policing, but they were developing this program with Los Angeles Police. This happens with the program called GOSM that I show in a clip of in the film, when it tries to as well just create different scenarios of all the kind of possible interactions between different armies in a particular context, and just predict what might happen so they can have an edge in stopping it before. It's all technology is about time and information. Or the play between both. The more you have control on it, you have control on what you effectuate in the world. So that's what Palantir does. And that's, for me, super interesting that you get inspired by an image as strong as the Palantir in The Lord of the Rings that was something actually where very clearly we're used for not the best reasons in the world, but you get inspired enough to call your company that. And then, aside from the metaphor, the hyperstition means the superstition that comes to reality is what's interesting for me, is that it's a narrative that was repeated enough that started to shape how you want to think about the world. You know what I mean? And this is the kind of thing I wanted to communicate in that part of the film. Like, reflect from all the way back from the time of the hegemons of the time, who are from the Islamic world, and go to another point in time with other hegemons and how they use the technologies.
That's what I wanted to remark. I mean, in The Lord of the Rings, also the clip that you show, it's clearly evil, like Sauron, like the evil whatever entity there.
I was a bit biased, but yeah.
Yeah, and I like your concept of this hyperstition. What did you say? It's like this superstition that it's not superstition anymore, but becomes real.
Yeah, it becomes real by virtue of its being repeated enough in a way, to the point that it starts growing roots in reality. Like it's super contagious and invasive to the point that you want to make it real and you work for it. And telling the future was always something that was very hyperstitional, in the sense that people will always work for it, you know, try to make it happen. And I think in a way, like, that's what Palantir is trying to do in a militarized context.
But this whole concept of predicting everything is also something, I mean, I guess something that's very old in the sense. I mean, I always think about this Laplace demon, the demon of Laplace, where like you could predict something, and we are kind of trying, or some people are trying, to live in this world where everything is like calculatable and predictable, therefore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we'll ever be in that world. It's just like realistically impossible, I think, hopefully. Also, like, I wouldn't want to live in that world. It's not super interesting. It's interesting to know some stuff. It's interesting to know if there's going to be an earthquake that's going to destroy an entire country. You know, yeah. It's important to find ways to know that. It's important to find ways to, but where do you stop? You know, where's the kind of the political and ethical line where you draw clear borders between the tools you have and what use you put them to? Because obviously something like the program, and it's all in the patents. Like if you go to Palantir's and you read the patents of the technologies they register, there's a huge bias in how they are thinking about their own processes. It's clearly there is an invasion of privacy that's going on there. It's clearly that they are using a certain kind of, they are basing the technologies based on, I think, cultural criterion that either are outdated or ideologically very biased, in a way. In how, for example, they create the profiles for the people who are going to police in that sense, or how actually, what is the criterion that decides who will get arrested and how we can predict if this person are going to do a crime or not. You know, it's incredibly biased. And this is where I think it's important to think about these lines of the political and ethical questions underlying the use of these things.
That's the part where I want to ask this question about the subtitle, because maybe that's fitting here, because it's called Stratagems for Undestining. And we did talk about, you know, kind of predicting everything. Undestining would be the opposite, or what is the meaning yeah. or what do you wanted to say with the subtitle actually?
Yeah, I think that it's kind of loaded and esoteric in a way, because it could mean different things, but there are two things that come to mind. It's like undestining in the sense when there is, in the second part of the film, there is talk about a certain kind of new value form for a post-computational world. And the undestining here is basically how can you think outside of the clutches of capitalism and how it orders or pre-orders our imaginaries for the future. Because it's for capitalism, we live in the very extended present, and that is the future for it. You just more and more and more of the same, and the undestining is the part where you try to break out of that. But as well, but also it's related to the kind of these models of trying to know the future or trying to be. It's not about you never know the future. What you do is just you try to order it in a way that it becomes, it's a very anti-democratic concept, because it's not about knowing, it's about intervening. You don't know, you just try to order the world in the way you want in that sense. So it's undestining in that it's escaping out of that as well. That's what I had in mind.
One thing that I found important and that found also interesting is like this thing with where you talk about value theory, like what is value? The Marxist view of value is like value is generated to work, but what happens when the work is not done by humans anymore, but by AIs or robots? Yeah, and robots.
you are in a clear like technological, but also cultural and political shift, where you are getting more jobs automated and more the human factor is becoming replaceable. And this is something that we have to plan for and tarry with, because it's going to happen either we like it or not, because that would make sense, you know? And the question is not, I think, like you had the similar, yani every historical moment where you have a change in the mode of production, you have the same anxieties rise, right? In the Industrial Revolution, it was all the same. You know, the machine will replace us. And, you know, a few hundred years later, you're asking if not just the machine, but a new form of intelligence will replace us. And, like, it depends on how this happens, obviously. Like, I think it's something that could be welcomed, because nobody wants to be doing, to be always in the clasp of all this capitalist madness. But at the same time, like, how do you prepare for that transition? Because whether we like it or not, there is going to be a huge number of people everywhere in the world that are jobless. It's just something that I think now it's starting to be clearly obvious that this is going to happen, and going to happen very fast. Like, for example, you have the same, like, the last few months, because of Midjourney and all, and like Disco Diffusion and all these software for image generation, you see a lot of artists, a lot of designers, a lot of architects, a lot of this and that are getting very threatened by the existence of this technology because they will replace their work. And, you know, the question that you have to ask yourself, if this is like very primitive software, because it is primitive, it's not one in a thousand of what it will be, are threatening you. Maybe we're not doing a good enough work in the first place, you know? Like, it's the same thing with ChatGPTs and academics. With all due respect and love to academics, but if you are really that concerned that maybe the academic form is one that is very uptight, that is very unoriginal in a way, and not trying to reinvent itself, that you feel threatened by this very primitive program. So, like, I don't know. I'm never a person who is very optimistic, to be honest. Like, I try to force myself to be, but there is something to be taking from all this anxiety that is generated about these new technologies. And I think more and more it will become clear that a discussion about the transition into that kind of world, and you have already, all kind of stuff being said about universal basic services and universal basic income, been in the talks for many years. But I think more and more it's going to become very urgent to actually imagine a world and plan for it, where human work is not something that is prior anymore.
Yeah. I guess what ChatGPT and also Stable Diffusion and all the image generators too, because it's also about art. And until now, people were like, oh, whatever, if a robot builds our cars or a robot deals with our like household trash or something, that's okay. But if the robot does like writes our poems and novels or and paints our pictures, that's like, oh my God, this is like human.
Yeah, like I'm not good anymore as a human, you know, like this is the point, which is an interesting point, to be honest. Yeah. Like, I think there's also like the first part of the film, there's a joke by the robot, which is about writing an English biography. But if he uses AI, then it's an autobiography. I think, it's a dad joke. It's a dad robot joke. but what's interesting in that is I think it's a joke about this anxiety for me. You know, it's about this anxiety of the Turing test, that you try to understand if of a computer program is intelligent enough to deceive you into thinking that it's a human. Yeah. But if that happens, what is the other side of the Turing test? If a computer program outsmarts you, or at least as smarts you, then what does it say about being human?
Yeah.
It doesn't say something about the machine, but it also says something about us, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what it was about, and that's what I find interesting.
Yeah, I liked the robot telling bad jokes, actually. I mean, you start with the robot and you end with the robot, so it's a bit like a how do you call it? Yeah, a circle coming back to the robot. Why this robot with the bad jokes?
I mean, for me also, to be honest, like the whole world is simian, you know? They're just different voices of simian for that. It's a program that can tell you Siri. It's a program that can tell you the future. It's a program that can tell you a very bad joke. It's all in that word. The Taban talking from the within the world of the film, but for me it's something that it's a little bit of cynicism that breaks the tone of the film, because as much as I want to be optimistic, I'm not really optimistic. like the end joke of the film tells a lot of, you know, all the conflicted, complicated, complex scenes that are struggling in the film. I mean, the jokes for me were just a narrative device to not just to break the tension, but also heighten it in a different way. Like, how much am I taking this seriously? Or how much am I believing that, you know? Yeah.
But what then stands out, actually, when you say this, is like this part in the last part of the film, you have this longish part in the red room where the voiceover is reading, obviously, Samuel Beckett, this fail again, try again, fail better, which is also a kind of taken out of context, this inspirational quote that goes through Instagram, while in Beckett, it's obviously more tragic or existential.
Yeah, this is one of the trickiest part of the film. Like I took a gamble with that one. But I think the reactions to it like made me feel that it might have worked, because I think like the fail again, fail better quote is what gives it away, you know. But like not a lot of people are familiar with the play itself. It's called Westward Ho.
Yeah.
But so I took a bit out of it and I used it for a variety of reasons. Like, one of them is when people are watching this, they actually think that it's AI generated.
Yeah.
Until they hear the quote and become familiar with it, and they say like, oh, is that actually Beckett? So I think the context of the film makes you anticipate that it's AI generated. But if you ask the question, what does that mean? You know, if you are in doubt that if it's AI generated or not, then what does that actually mean? Like, or what was actually Samuel Beckett doing then, you know? Because for me, like, Samuel Beckett has always been the human ChatGPT, you know? he is a great stylist, and he's a genius stylist in how he plays about the ins and outs of language itself, and he transcends semantics through his style in a way. And I found that super interesting in the context of also the, when we talk about the other side of the Turing test. I found that using Beckett here is a little bit of an interesting puzzle in a way. It's outside of what's happening, but it's also somewhat, for me at least, I found it does something different in the film, and it's a risky thing, but I the reactions to it made me feel that, okay, that maybe I have worked the way I want.
It also brings back the body, which is obviously something the AI doesn't have, like the meat body, the flesh that we are made of. But also on the visual level, I think you have these CGI-generated kind of body parts that are like flying around very
coherently. Yeah. I think that the story itself, I wanted it to be as abstract and situated in that world of Simia, that there is no clear ways of subjectification, like or pointing out to particular subjects. But I felt like this part, because it's the only part that's actually read by a human in the film, the Beckett story, and has a lot of affect going on in the telling itself, makes it interesting in that sense. So you don't, because in the terms of intelligence, it's what is the body but affect, you know? Like at the end of the day, it's this is what I think for me. What the bodily and the human distills more into it. It's not the intelligence, it's the affect. And this is might be the irreplaceable part of the intelligence we have as human, or of our own machinations as human. So yeah, I think this is the part where I felt it. I think what for me is when you have these robotic voices, all the film, and then you have this very poetic, very sensitive voice at the end, it becomes super amplified. More than you hear it in exclusion, you know. That was the particular part of the Beckett play. I think it complicates or kind of throws back the question about, what is the role of this artificial intelligence, but how do we relate to it as humans? How do we relate to it as humans is always going to be a very complicated question that might not have an answer, actually. And there's no one better than Beckett to complicate things for you, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a good end point, actually, because, yeah, I mean, it's about questions and what does this whole thing mean for us as humans, this AI, the body and the mind, where we could also say that the AI is this kind of giant artificial mind and we are the, I don't know, muddy children in our wetware bodies.
True. And all the small artificial intelligence parts will connect to create a very big one.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, thank you, Asim, for this really interesting talk. And I hope our listeners will want to see the film.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Das war Bilderdenken Nummer 7 mit einem Gespräch mit Asim Hindawi, dem Regisseur des Films Simya, Stratagems for Undestining, einem Film aus dem diesjährigen Forum Expanded-Programm. Mein Name ist Vali Djordjevic und vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.